This hour, we'll get three views of international politics. We'll talk with NPR's Rob Schmitz in Shanghai about how President-elect Trump upset Chinese officials by hinting the One China policy may be back on the table. And we'll talk with Manila-based Thomson Reuters correspondent Claire Baldwin about the Philippine president's bloody anti-drugs campaign, which has led to the deaths of thousands of people. But first, an update on Brexit. It may seem things have been quiet on the Brexit front recently, but that's just because many things are on hold while the British High Court decides whether the British Parliament has to approve a departure from the European Union. Earlier this year, in the Brexit referendum, a majority of the British electorate voted clearly to leave. However, last week, the High Court heard testimony as to whether the referendum is enough. Meanwhile, the current headlines in the UK have been about the possible status following a Brexit of the 3 million EU nationals currently living in the UK. Joining us on the line from London is the BBC political correspondent Ben Wright to bring us up to date. Hello, Ben.
Morning, Ewan.
Ben, let's start with those EU nationals. What's actually being discussed at the moment?
Well, they're agitating to stay in the UK quite vociferously. A petition was handed to Number 10 Downing Street, where the Prime Minister lives, earlier this week. A group calling themselves the 3 million group, demanding assurances that they won't be used as bargaining chips when negotiations between the UK and the EU begin, we expect, in the spring next year. They want guarantees that their status is going to be secure. And there are similar demands being made by the more than 1 million UK citizens living in the EU, places like Spain in particular. But at the moment, other than there being sort of fairly warm words from the British government about wanting to get this sorted out very early in the negotiation, nothing has actually been agreed. The UK government do not want to give a blank cheque on this issue. I think this will form part of the negotiations with EU states, and the UK government clearly hope that they come to some reciprocal arrangement very quickly to end the uncertainty that exists. And it's one of the most pressing issues, I think, on the government to sort out.
Well, I would assume that many of these people are working in important jobs, and if these 3 million people are forced to leave, that's a big hole in the workforce if they do go.
I mean, yeah.
What's been said about that?
You're right. I mean, there are concerns people have about, you know, the welfare of all of these EU workers living in the UK, the vast majority of whom are working, whether we're talking about French bankers in the City of London or Romanian Uber drivers or Polish potato pickers in Lincolnshire. I mean, they are deeply embedded and a valuable part of the UK economy. It's not just them and their families who want reassurances, but it's British businesses too, international businesses based in London, who want reassurances that this important part of the workforce will remain once negotiations begin and once Brexit actually happens. And so they're agitating for guarantees too. But it's a very big question mark at the moment, one of many question marks around the whole Brexit process.
Well, I wanted to also ask about the Britons living in European Union countries. I mean, there is, what, a million people, many of them
1.2 million, yeah.
Yeah, but in Spain alone, I've heard there's a million people, many of who have retired there and assumed they were going to spend the rest of their lives, probably, or much the rest of their lives there, and now their future is up in the air. And of course, they are an important part of the Spanish economy, which has been struggling itself. I mean, what's being said about those folks?
No, precisely right. I mean, wonderful though the British weather is, for some reason, some people do choose to go and spend their retirement in the sunshine in the south of Spain or the south of France on the Mediterranean. And there is concern about what rights they will have when Britain leaves the European Union, because they have many of them have bought properties. They have access, of course, to free EU healthcare and public services. And there's a big discussion now about what the acquired rights are going to be for people who want to remain living in the EU after the UK has left. And again, it's going to be a negotiation. It's going to be part of the trade-off. And I think the EU will say, well, look, if you guarantee that Polish nationals living in the UK can have access to free healthcare and can build up pensions and cash them in and buy houses, then the same will apply to UK nationals living in Spain in the future. But that's the nitty-gritty of the negotiation that needs to be sorted out.
We were talking about Brexit this morning with the BBC's Ben Wright, who joins us from London. Now, last week, there were several days of testimony before the High Court about whether or not the British Parliament has to vote on Britain leaving the EU. What were the arguments being made before the judges?
Well, it was pretty gripping, primarily because it's only very recently that we in the UK have seen any televised action from a UK courtroom. Most UK courts have no cameras in. Instead, people have to draw by hand pictures of the people who are giving evidence or the judges. But the Supreme Court, which is the UK's very highest court, does allow television cameras in. And over the course of 4 days last week, there was a considerable degree of public interest in what was being thrashed out. And it was a fascinating case. It is a fascinating case that goes to the heart of ancient constitutional rights, that goes to the heart of Brexit, that goes to the heart of issues around who actually has the power in the end to trigger the beginning of Britain's exit from the European Union. Now, the government's argument is, and has been since the referendum in the summer, that it has the right, based in ancient rights of royal prerogative, so the government acting on behalf of the crown, to take Britain out of the European Union. And they say that it has the license to do that from the referendum result, which was quite clear that whatever way it went, the government would have the power to act on it. But the reason that they find themselves in court now is that a group led by someone who works in the city argue that the government has no such right at all, and that because some rights will be lost that British citizens currently enjoy once we leave the European Union, rights that were originally passed by Parliament when we joined the European Union back in the 1970s, only Parliament can take those rights away by activating the beginning of the Brexit process. That's what the argument really comes down to. So the government say that they have the executive power to do this, but they're fighting a claim which argue the exact opposite. And they say Parliament needs to give its explicit approval before Brexit can begin. And the big problem, and this was thrashed out in the court last week, is that the Act of Parliament that paved the way for the referendum to happen, an act passed in 2015, didn't say anything about this issue. And I think some think that that's because members of Parliament at the time never expected us to be looking at leaving the European Union. The widespread expectation is that we would vote to remain in. But this Act of Parliament was silent on this really, really fundamental issue about the mechanism for beginning Britain's exit from the European Union. And that's what's being thrashed out now. We expect a verdict early next year, so early January. And if, as I think people expect at the moment, the judges second the opinion already passed down from the High Court that the government does need an Act of Parliament, then Theresa May, the Prime Minister, will have to get Parliament to green light this before she can begin negotiations with the European Union.
And the expectation was, at least given what was seemed to be coming out of Parliament during the campaign, was that many members of Parliament believe that the UK should stay in the European Union.
Yes, that's what's absolutely fascinating about this. A clear majority, I think probably four-fifths of members of Parliament, were vocal remainers. They wanted the UK to stay in, but the country voted the other way by a margin of 52-48. And of course, now many members of Parliament from all parties find themselves representing constituencies that voted the other way, that voted to leave. And so it's really interesting. It's back to sort of high school politics questions. Who are members of Parliament there to represent? Are they there to represent their constituents, their conscience, their party? For the first time in many years, these are really acute questions for members of Parliament. There is, though, no sense that even if Parliament is given the chance to vote on the beginning of Brexit next year, there is no sense that they will vote to block the beginning of the process, because they know that the people have spoken in this referendum. There was a clear majority to leave the European Union. There are hardly any voices who are saying that they are prepared to try and stymie and stop the process at this stage. Lots of questions what will happen later on and the role that Parliament might have in 2 or 3 years' time in approving the final deal. But at this stage, even though they theoretically could stand in the way of beginning Brexit, I think there is widespread understanding that the referendum result was clear and that MPs now have to allow this to happen.
Of course, and I have to bring that, bring this up, having grown up in Edinburgh, I know that there was a lot of Scots were a little irritated by by the vote and feel that perhaps their views are not represented as they voted overwhelmingly to stay in the European Union. And there has been this question as to the individual parliaments in Northern Ireland and Scotland and Wales, what their role is. What was that discussed in the High Court?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right about the difference. So there was a majority in favour of remaining in the European Union in Scotland and in Northern Ireland, whereas England and Wales voted to leave. And at the Supreme Court case last week, senior lawyers from both Northern Ireland and Scotland were given a chance to make their case, to argue that not only should the UK Parliament give their say, have to vote on the beginning of Brexit, but also that the devolved governments, so the government in Edinburgh, the government in Northern Ireland, had to give some sort of consent as well. It's not quite clear what sort of consent they're asking for. And I was following it, and it did become an exceptionally complicated constitutional argument, reflecting the fact that the UK is now made up of four clearly devolved components: England, Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland, and trying to work out what will be a massive change in the UK's foreign policy and how that needs the assent of its devolved components is something that was heard at the Supreme Court last week. My hunch is it's something that the Supreme Court judges will simply duck. I think it's incredibly controversial. There is, as you rightly say, a lot of agitation, particularly from Edinburgh, for a say. But there is no sense that the Parliament in Edinburgh will actually be able to block Brexit, even if there is some sort of way of consulting members of the Scottish Parliament. The lawyer representing the Scottish government said, we do not seek to and will not try to block Brexit. So again, that's another reason why we can't be certain about much in Brexit, but we can be certain that it will begin in the spring of next year.
Certainly, it's a full employment bill for political reporters anyway, such as yourselves.
We've never known a time like it, but, you know, nor of yours.
Well, we'll come to that in a moment, but I wanted to ask you about, there's something else. I mean, there's been a concern about a rise in hate crimes and racist attacks in the UK since Brexit. What's been happening with that?
Well, certainly in the month after the vote, so in July into August, there was a considerable jump in the number of racist, religious abuse incidents that happened that were recorded by police in England and Wales. There was a jump of 41%. That then tailed off a bit in the preceding couple of months, but it's remained at a higher level, incidents of hate crime, than existed before the referendum. And this is a cause of concern clearly for people at the moment. A few weeks ago, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which is the sort of a watchdog on these issues, expressed real concern that hate attacks had increased and made a plea for accurate information in public discourse and for a respectful political debate when it comes to Brexit, trying to calm the whole thing down. And the Home Office, the Interior Ministry, has said that they are putting more money in to this to make sure that they try and tackle hate crime. But it is definitely an issue of real public concern in the UK, even though the spike in actual hate crimes that we saw in the weeks after the referendum seemed to have dipped a bit in the last 2 or 3 months.
We should turn to the situation about US-UK relations, because, of course, President-elect Trump described himself as a Brexiteer, even though I think there's some evidence he wasn't entirely sure what it was about, at least on the day of the vote. He did meet with Nigel Farage, one of the leading Brexiteers, before he took a phone call from Prime Minister Theresa May, kind of showing where his allegiances lie. I mean, can you see an impact about what is happening with Brexit with UK-US relations?
I mean, it was extraordinary the way that Donald Trump, soon after he became president-elect, reached out to Nigel Farage very publicly and sort of, in a way, agitated for him to be part of the new diplomatic setup between the UK and the US, even suggesting that Nigel Farage could be the UK ambassador to Washington. I mean, a completely unprecedented sort of tearing up of the diplomatic rule book. And it caused considerable, I think, surprise and annoyance within the government, although they were very careful not to say that publicly. But it was just, it was early evidence.
They did decline, though, to, or they
said...
Politely.
But rather than saying, look, Donald Trump, get lost, you've got no role to be, you know, you've got no role in this whatsoever. The British ambassador to Washington is an appointment by the British government. It has nothing to do with you. Rather than saying that, the British government were careful and diplomatic and said, well, there's no vacancy at the moment and our current ambassador is doing a terribly good job. Can we please move the conversation on? It was awkward for them. And the British prize the idea and treasure the idea. There is a special political, security, historical relationship between us and you. And I think there was real concern that actually this could be put in real jeopardy, actually, with the new president and his approach to foreign relations. But, you know, work will be done behind the scenes now to try and patch that up to make sure there is an understanding. But it's clear that Nigel Farage, who would love to have a leading role bridging the Atlantic, is not going to have that role, at least not formally. The UK government has no interest in using him.
Ben Wright, we have just about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you that there was a feeling here that there was a certain amount of buyer's remorse about Brexit following the vote. What's the feeling now amongst the British public?
Interestingly, the latest polling indicates that the vote, if it was to happen again now, would be pretty much exactly the same. There isn't much buyer's remorse. I mean, it may, you know, there are. This is going to be a very long process. If negotiations begin in the spring, we're looking at, you know, a two-year process. There are great big unknowns around the economy. But at the moment, there is no remorse on either side. Remainers are convinced that Britain should have remained in. Brexiteers are convinced we should be leaving. And it feels like there is a big political chasm in the UK at the moment, which we haven't seen for many, many years. And it's something that is causing politicians quite a lot of concern.
Ben Wright is BBC political correspondent. He joined us from London this morning. Thanks very much for explaining some of the machinations of Brexit.
My pleasure.
And now to the Philippines. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte took office in July of this year. In the first several months of his presidency, he launched a violent campaign against drugs. Thousands of people have been killed by the police and by extrajudicial death squads. Many in the international community fear Duterte may be pushing the country towards authoritarianism. For a view from inside the Philippines, I spoke with Thomson Reuters correspondent Claire Baldwin. I started by asking her what she has seen of Duterte's anti-drugs campaign.
Rodrigo Duterte's campaign against drugs has taken the form of a number of what he calls Oplan Tokang operations, which are when the police go and knock on the doors of people in different neighborhoods and ask them to surrender, which means that they sign their name on a sheet of paper and admit that they're involved with drugs. It also means that there's been a huge increase in the number of undercover buy bust operations.
We have been hearing about a lot of extrajudicial killings too, though. I mean, are most Filipinos aware of the bloody brutality of what's going on?
Yeah, I think they are. So drugs and crime have been something that people have felt very strongly about for a long time, and nothing's happened. So the surprising thing is that despite the killings, it's a very popular campaign. But yeah, there's an awful lot of them. I mean, the project that we did recently that really highlighted this was we went to a total of about 51 different drug buy bust operations. 42 of those were ones that we, Reuters journalists, attended ourselves, and another 9 were cases that we obtained from the Commission on Human Rights, which is a Philippine government-funded body. And between all of those cases that there were more than 100 people killed. And of those cases, there were only 3 people wounded, which means that there's a 97% kill rate.
That just is astonishing. I mean, what was it like for you as a journalist covering this?
Exhausting. I mean, kind of the way that these cases are covered is there's one of the central police district headquarters that a lot of the journalists wait at overnight. And then when somebody gets a call about an operation, everybody gets into a convoy of cars, goes to the scene, and begins reporting. And sometimes you'll arrive before the police, sometimes you arrive at the same time. And it's dark, it's quite chaotic. The family members and neighbors are all out in the streets. Often the victim is still there. And the police are kind of trying to secure the scene, and the crime scene investigators are there as well at the same time.
So President Duterte has said that the Philippines faces collapse if the drug menace isn't tackled, the drug menace as he calls it. Is this true? I mean, what is the situation with drugs in the Philippines?
So that's a very good question. The president has repeatedly said that it's a massive problem. One of his latest statements was that there's more than 4 million addicts. But there was another story that we did looking at the exact scope of the problem, and it's actually much smaller, according to the Philippines government data itself. So there's something called the Dangerous Drugs Board, and then there's another group called PDEA, which is the Philippine Drug Enforcement Agency. And those are two Philippine government bodies responsible for drugs. And they've done some surveys, and it's actually only about 1.8 million people in the country who are addicted to drugs, according to their own data. And of those, only about 800,000 are shabu users. And shabu is the local name for methamphetamine. And that's the drug that the president has identified as the main problem.
And when he says a problem, is he talking about the crime associated with it, or are there other things he's concerned about?
I think it's primarily crime. I mean, the link that he keeps making in his speeches are that you use drugs, you commit a crime, and that the two are one and the same. So if you begin speaking to experts about it as well, they say that that linkage is not as clear.
We are talking with Thomson Reuters correspondent Claire Baldwin. She joins us by Skype from Manila in the Philippines. So, how effective has the president's campaign been in actually fighting this drug problem, or indeed in fighting crime?
Well, so crime has dropped, but it's hard to say that it's a direct result of the war on drugs, because it was dropping even prior to President Duterte taking office.
And you said that generally people are in support of the war on drugs. But it must be terribly worrying, terribly scary to be in a place where there are so many people being basically summarily executed on the streets.
Yeah, and it's amazing when you start talking to the families of some of these victims who've died in operations, that they're really afraid. You know, some of them have received threats. Some of them have left their homes because they no longer feel safe and they feel like they are targets themselves. They're staying with friends. They've gone to family in the provinces. They're just scared and they feel like there's nothing they can do about it.
And I mean, if people approve of the campaign, do they really approve of Duterte himself?
When you ask people about the war on drugs and about the president, they say that they want something to happen, and that it's that's what they're responding to, and that they believe drugs and crime are a problem, and so any action on that front is good. But then if you push them a little bit, they will often say they don't approve of the killings.
And is anybody actually speaking out, really campaigning against what's going on?
It's been remarkably quiet in terms of people speaking out against the killings. You're starting to see some of that now. But in the past couple of months, the Catholic Church, for example, which is a major force in the Philippines, really took a long time to say very much at all.
We are talking with Thomson Reuters correspondent Claire Baldwin. She joins us via Skype from Manila in the Philippines. President Duterte has said that Donald Trump endorses his anti-drug campaign. How do you see the relationship between these two leaders? Clearly, there was a very tense relationship with President Obama, but how do you see things playing out?
Well, it's interesting looking at how President Duterte sees the role of the Philippines in the world. He's definitely made no bones about cursing world leaders, world bodies, human rights activists, journalists, presidents, the Pope. So he doesn't seem to shy away from taking a confrontational stance.
But given that he seems to be taking some approval from President-elect Trump, might he build on that, do you think?
Yeah, it'll be definitely something that's interesting to watch. I think you've got two outspoken leaders, and we have yet to really see what they're like together in the same room.
You mentioned about going out and covering the story. How does it affect you personally, seeing all this on a daily basis?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I think that you have to take regular breaks. You have to have a team that you work well with and that you trust, and keep talking about it and watching for signs of stress. It's definitely a challenging type of story to cover. Another one of the projects that we've worked on here is following a family all the way from when their family member was shot to the time that they buried him, including through the autopsy. So this family, for example, they didn't believe the police version of events. And so they went to CHR, which is the government-funded Commission on Human Rights, and they requested a second autopsy. And they wanted media present. And so we were in touch with them, and they asked us to sit in. So it was myself and two photographers. And we interviewed the doctors doing the autopsy, and we're speaking to the family and photographing the entire thing. And that's challenging.
Has your daily life, your daily work changed since President Duterte came to power?
Tremendously. So I'm based in Hong Kong. And I've, over the past several months, been taking trips down to Manila to cover the drug war. And so I'll come down for between 2 weeks and 4 weeks at a time. And it's very full on, you know, basically from the time I land until the time I go, I'm running around trying to do interviews, meet families, go into some of these neighborhoods, and find out what's going on.
We've been talking clearly about the drug issue in the Philippines. Are there other worrisome trends happening right now in the country, or are there encouraging trends in your view?
Well, one thing that we've been very interested in is how the police are responding to accusations of extrajudicial killings. So there's something called the IAS, which is Internal Affairs Service, which is the internal police body responsible for investigating every time a police weapon is discharged. So one of the things that we did is we went to them and we asked, so what happens in these investigations? What are you finding? And since the beginning of the war on drugs, at the beginning of July, they've investigated more than 1,500 cases. And they go through a process, and they're an administrative body, not a criminal body. So what can come out of it is that the police officers involved can be dismissed or demoted. And so of those more than 1,500 cases, only 29 of them have made it to the stage where they're going through something called summary hearings. which is kind of similar to a court hearing, but in an administrative sense. The IAS officers were telling us that 21 of those cases are likely to be dismissed on self-defense charges. And they also said that not a single officer has been dismissed due to the drug war.
That's pretty bleak. Those are pretty bleak figures.
Yeah, that's kind of the process, and that number keeps changing as they review more cases. But as of the time that we published, that was the current figure.
So just to look into the future, do you just see this is going to be really what you're going to be doing, covering the Philippines for the next few years, just revisiting these kinds of stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're trying to watch how this drug war is being carried out and what's changing. It's been going about 6 months now. So it began at the beginning of July. End of December is a six-month timestamp. And the president said initially that he was going to eliminate the drug problem in 3 months, and then he extended it to 6 months. So each time we pass one of these time marks, we kind of have to see where we're at. And right now, there's been more than 2,000 people killed in police operations, another 3,000 by vigilantes. I think the questions are, where do we stand at the end of December? Where does public opinion stand? Are there other methods that the president and the police force might bring online?
Thomson Reuters correspondent Claire Baldwin, who joined us via Skype from Manila. Next up, we'll take a look at what's happening in China. But first, Phil Picardi is on hand with the hour's news headlines. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Ewan. Russia's foreign minister is offering cautious praise for President-elect Donald Trump's choice of U.S. Secretary of State. Sergei Lavrov says the pragmatism by ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson is a good basis for future relations. Senate Democrats and some Republicans have expressed concern about Tillerson's business ties to Russia. Sources say President-elect Donald Trump has selected former Texas Governor Rick Perry to lead the Energy Department. One of Perry's best-remembered moments from his first White House run was when he could not remember in a debate the third of three federal agencies he promised to eliminate if elected. The one he forgot was the Energy Department. Today at Trump Tower in Manhattan, Donald Trump met with rapper Kanye West. Trump called West a friend and says the two men discussed life. The UN Human Rights Agency says pro-government forces reportedly killed 82 civilians as they closed in on the last rebel enclave in Aleppo, Syria. Meanwhile, the UN says there could be more than 100 unaccompanied children trapped in a building under fire in eastern Aleppo. The UN Children's Agency says about 35,000 children have fled from Mosul since Iraqi forces, and a U.S.-led coalition launched a massive operation to retake the city from the Islamic State group. The children are among some 94,000 people who have fled since the operation began in mid-October. And a Japanese cargo ship pulled up to the International Space Station today bearing gifts. The ship dropped off nearly 5 tons of food, water, batteries, and other supplies. The capsule was secured by the station's robot arm, operated by Commander Shane Kimbrough, an American. Kimbrough says the crew is really excited to accept delivery. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:42.
Programming is supported by Health Partners and MakeItOkay.org, a campaign to start conversations about mental illness and stop the stigma. You can learn more about the misconceptions around mental illness at MakeItOkay.org.
You are listening to NPR News. I'm Ewan Kerr. President-elect Donald Trump is signaling a get-tough approach with China on a few different fronts. We're joined by former Minnesota Public Radio reporter Rob Schmitz, who now covers China for NPR. He's also the author of the recent book, Street of Eternal Happiness, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road. He joins me on the line from Shanghai.
Good morning, Ewan.
Good morning, good morning. So over the weekend, President-elect Trump hinted that he may not stick with the long-held One China policy, and that caused quite a lot of ructions. Briefly explain, what is the One China policy?
I'm glad you asked that, because that is something that I think a lot of people are starting to wonder, because we haven't talked about it for many, many years. The One China policy is basically the idea that there is one state that's called China, despite the fact that there exists two governments that claim to be China, and that's the People's Republic of China, which is also known as mainland China, and the Republic of China, which is also known as Taiwan. And so since the 1970s, many countries that have wanted to do business with China, with mainland China, or wanted to be diplomatically recognized by the People's Republic of China, had to first agree to basically to be on board with this policy of one China, that Taiwan does belong to the People's Republic of China, and it is a mere renegade province.
This policy has been held since the 70s, since Nixon, basically.
And yeah, this goes back 40 years almost.
But over the weekend, President-elect Trump hinted that he may not be interested in sticking with this. What kind of reaction has that caused in China?
When President-elect Trump accepted a call from the Taiwanese president, Tsai Ing-wen, more than a week ago, that was sort of met with a lot of confusion. I think there was a somewhat muted response by the Chinese press as well as the foreign ministry here in China about the entire affair, because this is a government that was actually sort of pushing for Trump in the presidential election. And when he won, the Chinese leadership seemed to be much happier than they would have been if Clinton would have won. And so I think that in some ways, the government was caught off guard, and they didn't really know how to respond. And so they responded surprisingly very diplomatically, saying, okay, well, he's not up to speed on this yet. It's a steep learning curve, and we'll make sure that he understands it. A week later, and now that he's questioned the entire principle of the policy, and also in that week, we've discovered that this call had been, much time in the making, involving lobbyists, including Bob Dole. It doesn't look as if it were a naive kind of mistake that President-elect Trump made. And so I think the Chinese are starting to change their response slightly. It's still pretty diplomatic, I would say, but I think that the state media here in China has been sort of unleashed, and a lot of the editorial today that came out very quickly after Trump's comments were pretty strong. They were threatening, and the Global Times, for example, threatened, if this happens while he is in office, that China will be forced to maybe start helping our foe. The foreign ministry response today also said that the One China policy, which it said is the basis of our relationship with the United States, is not recognized, then we will not be able to cooperate on a number of issues. And so this is becoming a very serious matter.
China has been kind of an obsession of Donald Trump's. I mean, throughout the election campaign, he continually referred to and beat up on Chinese trade practices and monetary policy. Now, here's what he said just the other day in Iowa during his victory tour of swing states.
The nation of China is responsible for almost half of America's trade deficit. China is not a market economy. They get a lot of help. And that's why we designate them as being a non-market economy. Big thing. They haven't played by the rules. And I know it's time that they're going to start. They're going to start. They've got to. We're all in this thing together, folks. We got to play by the rules, folks.
Could we be about to see a massive change in how the U.S. approaches China?
I think anybody who has an answer to that doesn't. It's going to be difficult to tell until January 20th when he is in office. There are a lot of theories about why Trump is doing what he's doing on the One China front, at least. Many folks think that he's trying to set China off balance, which is something that China in the last few years has done quite a bit to the United States as well as other developed countries and its political relationships. But I think when you look at the economy, Trump promised to label China a currency manipulator on day one in office. He also promised imposing very large tariffs on Chinese imports. Neither of those two actions is going to be seen very well among any businesses that do business here in China who are from the United States. And I think businessmen that I talk to here are a little worried about that. And many of them actually don't think that Trump will do that once he has had longer conversations with the business community here, that he will actually go back on his word. Because in fact, you know, if he does label China a currency manipulator, which sets in process an entire kind of a process with the Department of Treasury and Commerce, then it doesn't really make sense, because China is actually manipulating its currency, but it's manipulating it at this stage the other way around. So if China were to actually let market forces decide its currency, the currency would weaken, which is not good for the United States. It's trying to actually strengthen its currency. And so it's that whole fundamental principle is based on a flawed understanding of what's going on here in China.
On the line from Shanghai today, we have NPR China correspondent Rob Schmitz. So, Rob, I wanted to play another piece of tape from his speech in Iowa last week. And this is basically a listing of his grievances.
You have the massive theft of intellectual property, putting unfair taxes on our companies, not helping with the menace of North Korea like they should, and the at-will and massive devaluation of their currency and product dumping. Other than that, they've been wonderful, right?
Rob, to be fair, other administrations, other U.S. administrations have complained about the same thing, but why hasn't the U.S. taken a stronger action against China? And what were other presidents worried would happen if they did?
Well, I think part of the reason is that there is such a strong economic bond right now between the United States and China. I mean, we are almost one single economy. $600 billion worth of trade happens between our two countries, the first and second largest economies on the planet. So I think part of the reason that not much is done on this front is that very fact. That trade between the two countries is massive. And, you know, in the last 8 years at least, I think the United States has tried to rebuild its economy after the financial crisis, you know, in 2007, 2008. And so it really didn't have much leverage in that. At the same time, China was still growing extremely rapidly and doing a lot of business around the world. So China had it has increasingly more leverage in its relationship with the United States. So I think right now we're in a very interesting point, because both countries are sort of, you know, China's slowed down a bit its economy. It's trying to make an economic transition right now, and its economy isn't looking as good as it did 5 years ago, and the U.S. as well in some ways. So I think both countries seem to be poised to kind of reassess the entire trade situation. But I think it's going to be difficult, because there still is a massive amount of trade done between the two countries. And we still, for all practical purposes, need each other very much when it comes to the health of both of our economies.
President-elect Trump has named Iowa's longtime governor, Terry Branstad, as his choice for ambassador to China. That went over pretty well in Beijing, apparently. Why was that?
Yeah, this is about the best person you could probably appoint to ambassador to China from the United States. Terry Branstad, he, you know, obviously is the longest-serving governor in the United States. And when he was serving his first term in the mid-1980s, he met a much younger Xi Jinping, who is now the president of China, when she was actually kind of a low-level agricultural official from Hebei province in the northern part of China. And that meeting, when Xi Jinping came to Iowa and he stayed with a host family on a farm, was very impressionable on Xi Jinping. And since then, Xi Jinping and Terry Branstad have had a relationship, a personal relationship, where they've met several times. Xi Jinping has actually invited Branstad to China, and Branstad has been to China several times. Xi Jinping came back to Iowa when he was about to be president in 2012. So I think, you know, that relationship, and I don't think it's, you know, it's more than, you know, I think it really is a friendship, according to people who are close to Branstad and to Xi, that these two men actually genuinely like each other. They both understand the importance of agriculture. And they have a lot of sort of similar backgrounds in some ways. And so I think these two guys are already have a friendship, and I can't think of a better person really to be in that position at this stage, especially when President-elect Trump is already making some controversial remarks that that are already upsetting China quite a bit.
Well, you have to wonder when the elephants of international diplomacy start dancing, though, doesn't the grass of friendship get trampled?
Yeah, and you know, I think that the ambassador position, of course, is more or less you're basically doing the president's will, and so I think. But you know, again, we don't know what that will be once Trump is in office. You know, I think nobody seems to understand what's going to happen once he's in office, and I think it's a good sign that Branstad has been chosen for ambassador. I think that Branstad does understand the relationship pretty well. And if Trump wants to learn more about the relationship between the United States and China and a lot of the complexities of it, he can turn to Branstad, and Branstad could definitely explain this to him.
We are checking in with three parts of the world today, and helping us from Shanghai is NPR China correspondent Rob Schmitz. Now, economy aside, the U.S. has also been doing a strategic dance with China over military influence in the region. And the U.S. has complained bitterly about these artificial islands China is building and claiming in the South China Sea. Basically, it seems that it's to give some sort of advantage over key shipping routes. Is there any reason to think that the U.S. approach to China's military will change?
Yes, in some ways there is, because when you look at who Trump's China advisors are, these are all people who have advocated for a much stronger naval presence in that region. One of his advisors, Peter Navarro, has written about how the United States needs to add dozens of ships to its fleet to help protect that area as well as Taiwan. So there is reason to believe that Trump may, at least when you look at what his advisors are thinking, may want to confront China on what it's doing in that region. You know, China's been, as you mentioned, building artificial islands in areas that are disputed territory. These are territories that other countries in the region, like the Philippines and Vietnam, also claim as theirs. It's been a very controversial act in the region, and it's really made the region in some ways unstable for the first time ever. And so, yeah, I think that this is something that I think China's going to be watching very, very closely. And I think that if you look at how Trump seems to be seeing this relationship, I'm sure it's inevitable that he'll be using this as sort of a bargaining chip in his negotiating with China on other separate issues.
One other local issue we should talk about specifically is steel. Minnesota politicians do a great deal of hand-wringing over the perceptions that China is dumping cheap steel onto the world market. Obviously, that has a big impact on the iron or mining industry here. You know, what's the best case scenario for the U.S. steel industry from a get-tough approach to China, which seems to be coming from the Trump administration?
Well, with that relationship, I mean, China definitely is dumping steel. And, you know, the part of the problem here is that China's state sector has been just sort of bloated, and you still have many of these steel foundries still, actually fabricating steel, even though they don't even need to, and thus dumping it abroad, pushing down the prices and hurting other countries' steel as well. And so, you know, this is in many ways the essence of this problem, is that China is trying to maintain a labor force. It doesn't want to lay off thousands and thousands of workers from these state-owned factories and suddenly have a massive unemployment problem. And so as it's transitioning from a more state-controlled economy to a more service-oriented economy, I think you're going to see a lot of problems like this. I mean, this is one of many problems that we're seeing here. Also in the coal industry, we're seeing the same thing, where they need to they don't need as many coal mines as they actually have, but they're having a hard time laying off these people because, these are all young men, middle-aged men, and they are, skilled only to do this. And it's difficult to retrain them. And, we're talking about China here, so the scale is just massive. You've got millions of people in both of these industries.
Rob Schmitz covers China for NPR. He joined us today from Shanghai. Great to talk with you, Rob. Thank you.
Great to talk to you too, Ewan. Thanks a lot.